Hello and welcome back to the Microsoft Virtual Academy. This is the second presentation in a three-part series on application compatibility and what you can do to help move customers forward from older versions of the Microsoft platform onto newer versions. In the first episode, we talked a bit about sort of the general principles behind designing a really good app compat project and how those impact how you deal with application inventories as a whole, as well as how you would deal with individual applications and interpret that data. In this session, we want to talk about the process itself and how you apply those principles to the tools that you leverage, as well as to the program that you built and the project structures and flow charts that you devised to help get through the app compat process. My name is Chris Jackson. I'll be taking you along on this journey. I'm frequently known as the app compat guy. I'm an architect who's been working in the application compatibility space since about 2006 or so, way back in the Vista days. So I've been doing it for a little bit of time. So with no further ado, I kind of want to get started talking initially about tools and how we've applied those tools to the processes that we and aspirations that we have based upon that first presentation on the fundamental principles of app compat. And of course, the tool that most people come across when dealing with app compat from Microsoft is the Application Compatibility Toolkit, or ACT, which is currently in version 6.0 for Windows 8. And some of the goals that we had in the evolution for ACT 6.0 were to really focus on implementing a lot of those principles that we talked about. I think one of the things where a lot of customers have found some very strong value in is in how we help facilitate application discovery. What applications are being run in the environment? You know, it's extremely thorough, more thorough than most other systems management tools out there. We're quite simply just looking in more places. So if you feel that there's hidden risk, it can do a really good job of helping you surface that hidden disk. It also helps you to get to know the known data. So, you know, the information that is already well known about the applications that you are running inside of your environment. It helps you with testing for those issues and tracking that testing, as well as helping you with mitigation and helping you to solve the problems that you come across. So it's been a little bit of a different story since Act 5.6, which really placed a lot of focus. You can see in bullet point number one here on the collection point, a lot of focus was placed on helping to assess compatibility via down-level evaluators. In the first segment, we talked a little bit about probabilities, so I'll kind of spill the beans on what we found here. The compatibility evaluators that we leveraged in Act 5.0, in 5.5, and in 5.6 were really designed and focused on issue-level accuracy. We looked for around a dozen specific issues, and if you had one of them, we would report that you had that one. And it turns out that those were not terribly predictive on whether or not the application as a whole would work. And in fact, we discovered that we did roughly as well as chance at telling you whether or not the application as a whole was going to work on the platform to which you were transitioning. And that really didn't meet with customer expectations. You know, we did terrific on the issues. We did not so good on the app as a whole. And it turns out that really picking one generally means, you know, not optimizing for the other one, and we made the choice to get issue fidelity. So the data ended up being pretty useful if we saw that you did have something that would help you troubleshoot that, but it ended up being not so useful if you were trying to do budget estimations. So we actually moved away from that in Act 6. So some of the differences and the high-level changes that we put in place, Act 5.6 was its own separate download, whereas in Act 6.0, we've actually integrated that into the Windows Assessment and Deployment Kit. It's a part of that install experience. We looked at testing and inventory as one combined thing. You deploy an evaluator that gathers the inventory and does some down-level testing. Since that didn't meet with end-user expectations, customer expectations, we've separated them out and looked to instead support pilot testing and support lab testing and keeping those as two distinct entities. So rather than doing the down-level testing, which 5.6 and earlier had done, now we do the testing on the target operating system and help to support that as well. So rather than having disparate tools across there, so a collection of tools, we did more integration work in Act 6.0 to make it feel more like a consolidated experience. So now we looked from an Act 6.0 perspective at having a bit of a longer pipeline where we look at collecting the inventory, planning our testing, testing and monitoring using the tools that we have, analyzing the results, and providing the mitigation. And we look at, you know, how that applies from a workflow perspective, right? The first thing we need to do is we need to gather the inventory and populate the initial database. You know, that inventory is going to, you know, allow us to, you know, synchronize and bring information together. In fact, it probably is a little bit easier to visualize that when we say, all right, we're going to deploy the inventory collector. We're going to have that landing on all the different desktops, and we're going to understand where all of those applications exist, feed that back into exactly the same database, and that way we can start to analyze the information that comes into play. One of the first things that people want to know is, for the applications that exist, which one of those are known to work or not already? So for that, we go into the compatibility exchange, which allows us to go through and do some metrics and say, these are certified for the platform to which I'm transitioning. So from a confidence level, I'm fairly sure that that's probably going to work. That's likely to inform my workflow. I'm going to have some that are going to be known not to work, and those will be reported. That's going to inform how I handle that application in my workflow. It helps me to gather that. So from an expectation standpoint, when we look at vendor information, what we tend to find on average is that around 12% of applications will have a match, you know, which may not seem like what you're expecting, but on average, roughly about 50% of applications or even third-party applications. So clearly, we can't know too much about applications that you've developed because you're the only one that has them. So already, we're knocking out 50% of being possible to find in there. And from there on out, sort of the complications that lie are, you know, if I've done some repackaging work, the repackaging may impact the name that shows up in the inventory, and so therefore I may not have a match as a result of that. It also may be the case that I'm running a particular version that not a lot of people have looked at. We have done some work to try and do some forward pathing in Act 6.0 and try to start to rationalize and group together by major version number to start bringing this information together and starting off with about that 12% match rate. And the actual match rate tends to vary by the size of your inventory. The more applications you have, the lower the match rate tends to be because, you know, with that variety tends to come a lot of lesser known applications. It's a lot of the most well-known applications that everyone has and that show up in large inventories that increase that success rate there. So with that fundamental baseline of knowledge, what's already known, the tool can then support testing by end users. So by deploying a runtime analysis package, that allows us to let end users go through, perform testing, and have us do some monitoring, right? And what's different in that testing and monitoring is we will allow you to capture screenshots and post them directly to the database. So now I have a single centralized hub for all of the information I have in that database. We allow you to actually use the problem step recorder, which records an entire sequence of steps, every button click that's being pressed, screenshots when all these activities happen so that we don't miss the one critical step. That's incorporated into the runtime analysis package. We plug into the program compatibility assistant, which allows us to monitor some critical events, application crashes, as you might expect. We look for things like hard-coded version checks. We actually will read dialog boxes. And if we see you referencing Windows XP, we assume that that might potentially be an issue. So we actually do quite a bit of work in the runtime analysis package to try and bring knowledge into play. The other thing we allow, which is new for Act 6.0, is we allow you to add applications which don't show up in the traditional inventory and point the application towards them to instead enhance the inventory for something that may have flown under the radar for inventory collection. All of this continuing to come back into this one central database, which you could potentially use to drive the entire project end to end and track the state of compatibility. When we think about collecting inventory, let's go with some of the details that we have here. Installing ACT is part of installing the Assessment and Deployment Kit, or ADK. The next thing we need to do is we need to make sure that we have a solid infrastructure plan that understands, do we have this thing scaled up to be able to handle as many logs as we intend to get from the number of machines that we plan on gathering an inventory from. We look at making sure that we have log processing shares available in places that are accessible from the network from all of our target devices. So what are the considerations that we have for ensuring that we can gather logs, place them to a file share, process them, and have a database that's sufficiently sized? Because we have removed down-level compatibility evaluation, there's a lot less consideration that we need to place in terms of, you know, scaling and throughput, because it tends to be fairly difficult overall to just do an inventory-only package that ends up saturating, you know, even an averagely scaled server and, you know, SQL infrastructure. But nonetheless, it does behoove us to have a really good solid plan. We create and deploy the inventory collector to those devices. The logs come back in. We process the logs, and they go into that single centralized database. So fairly straightforward. Not a whole lot of change from Act 5.6 in terms of how we would do inventory, if you're familiar with that product. Once we have the inventory, that helps us to begin planning our testing. So when we think about taking that inventory and really making sense of it, what most people initially discover is that the inventory is quite a bit larger than they expected it to be, particularly if users are coming from an environment in which they are all running as local administrators on their computers, because as local administrators, they can literally, and often do, install whatever software they want to install. And so you find a lot of applications that, you know, are installed by end users. The other thing that we see coming in are applications where we left some evidence in add remove programs or in the MSI database, but it's not really an app. You know, it's really just an application update, but it got recorded there. We've also seen a lot of cases where it's not really an app, it's just the mechanism through which the drivers were deployed, right? And all drivers do matter. What we really care about from that perspective is the device and not necessarily the driver package. If we have a compatible device, typically we have an updated driver package, and we usually consider that to be a separate effort. So when we think about starting from a raw inventory and planning out my testing, a really key step is to go through and perform that rationalization to figure out which applications are in scope to do the testing. And furthermore, to do some prioritization so that we start looking at which are my most critical applications, which ones should I test at all, which ones am I going to mark as out of scope, all of that being supported by the categorization feature within Act 6. It allows me to go through and apply that. Part of that is also gathering known knowledge through synchronization with the compatibility exchange. One of the most common questions we get for the compatibility exchange is, what are you sharing? It was so common, in fact, that what we did was we provided what we called sync audit, is the actual feature name, and from an internal product group perspective. Basically, when you're performing a sync, before we send or receive anything, we give you the option to dump the entire XML that we intend to send as part of that conversation with the server. So you can see not just the type of data that will be sent up, but the actual data which will be sent up as part of that sync and evaluate that. There's also a link to the full privacy statement that lets you know how we secure the data in transit, that lets you know how we secure the data at rest, so you can measure whether or not that fits with your security requirements for sharing that information. In essence, we have to know what applications you have in order to determine the applications that we give you data on, right? We give the ability to do grouping. We talked about that from an automatic rationalization. It doesn't do a complete rationalization, so I think probably the biggest impact you can have from a planning basis is to go through and really leverage categorizations and try to get it down to that concept we mentioned in the first, you know, webcast in the series, which is, first of all, get into a four-tiered, managed, supported, unsupported, and banned, and ensure that the things that you're going to consider in scope are your managed applications, right? Supported applications, you'll take calls on after deployment. You'll take calls on as part of the pilot. You're not going to look at them up front. And within my managed application, prioritize them. I like to use, you know, platinum, gold, silver, and bronze, because it kind of resonates, you know, kind of in an Olympics kind of way with, hey, these really are my absolutely most critical apps and start differentiating there. There's a prioritization scheme that comes in the product. You can certainly re-leverage that as well. But to go through and apply that information before I begin my testing in order to really drive that testing. Once I am testing, we have the ability to leverage a runtime analysis package to support that testing. So this is a completely different approach from what we did in the past. We look at running it on the same computer using a tool that we call the compatibility monitor that lets the users provide open-ended feedback. There's nothing visibly wrong. There's no, you know, program compatibility assistant events that took place, but something's not right. We give a mechanism for the user to report that. We give a mechanism for the user to report a screenshot. This is not right. Or a full-on recording to record the steps end-to-end, leveraging the problem step recorder that's built into Windows. We record crashes, and we also give them the ability to use tools. Now, if it's an end-user testing and user acceptance testing, that's not so interesting. The scenario we're looking at there is if we have a technical tester or someone who is working with the end user who's doing a troubleshoot, that they have the tools right there installed as part of the runtime analysis package to go through and do some troubleshooting on the spot. So that is part of the package to really support testing in a very robust way. As the testing results are coming in, we have the ability to go through and do analysis. So we can see what the users are saying, this works or this doesn't work, to get us to that, you know, red, amber, green rating, right? Or in this case, red or green. Does it work or does it not work? And that's really, in the end, what I need to have. I need to have an upvote or a downvote. When we have a red status, we have the ability to dive in and see what are the issues that you're detecting. And we can even see the timelines. We can see over time, did something happen? Because it absolutely does happen from time to time where we'll have applications that initially pass and subsequently fail because there are changes in the image or in the applications that are deployed with that, and we can start to see some of those correlations over time by having the timeline feature built into that analysis. The next component of the tools that we provide in ACT are the ability to fix applications through a technology that we call AppCompat Shims. So the tools are mostly unchanged from Act 5.6, and we're actually going to take a bit of a deep dive into those when we talk about remediation in the next and final webcast in this series. But it lets us go through and research and find whether there's a vendor-supported version, apply shims to the application the way that we did historically. In general, we like to fix issues in the code, and we'll kind of talk about the remediation options a little bit later on in this webcast. But if there are any specific questions, write a couple of helpful links. The ADK, this is a link to that download page. So you can go through and find the ADK that includes the application compatibility toolkit. It is no longer a separate download, so that's important to remember. For developers, we also publish the Windows Compatibility Cookbook, which tells about what's different. So you'll actually find, particularly if you're coming from Windows XP, that we had a Windows Vista Compatibility Cookbook that addressed the difference between Windows XP and Windows Vista. There was the Windows 7 Application Quality Cookbook. For some reason, we changed the name. They are basically the same team looking to create this. They just kind of subtly changed the name. For Windows 8, we changed it back, so we thought it was more discoverable that way. But anyone going from Windows XP to Windows 8 would use all three, right? Changes for, you know, along the way. The Windows Vista Compatibility Cookbook, the Windows 7 Quality Cookbook, and the Windows 8 Compatibility Cookbook. The sum of those three indicates the change coming from XP, and just pick the ones that are relevant for the transition you're going through. We provide the compatibility list in a downloadable format for IT pros. We also provide the Windows Compatibility Center, which is at windows.com/compatibility, that you can go through and do online searches for software to see whether there is known information. We also give some email addresses. My email address is appcompatguy@microsoft.com. Mark Sweekall is the program manager for the AppCompat Toolkit. He's provided his email address here. We also have the generic ACT feedback, which is often a lot better to hit a group alias rather than an individual. That way you don't get hit with as many vacation problems, is to talk about ACT feedback. But what we've really tried to do in the context of ACT for version 6 is to take what really worked well in previous versions, remove that which was not working as well, and add new functionalities to support those basic fundamental principles that we talked about in that first webcast. So kind of diverging a bit from the tools, what I wanted to look at now is from a testing perspective, what are the workflows that you ought to be building in from a process perspective based on some of the best practices that we've discovered working with other customers? So I have a fairly generic workflow that I normally begin with here, and obviously there's a few more steps to this. When we think about AppCompat testing overall, we first of all need to figure out how much work are we going to put in up front before we put the application in front of a user. And that determination, based upon how cooperative my end users tend to be, really determines what I build into my process. So when we look at, having end users who really don't like to have their time wasted, and of course no one likes to have their time wasted, but they're particularly vocal about it, right? That tends to drive customers who have very pain-averse end users to put in more upfront time to try and drive the accuracy rate up, right? So here's what I mean in terms of driving the accuracy rate up. A very lightweight process would potentially include running some form of static analysis. We've had a lot of customers who have worked with some of the partners that we have who are doing static analysis, which has proven to be particularly effective for customers transitioning from Windows XP to Windows 7 as well as to Windows 8. Static analysis, tends to have an accuracy rate. We looked at this actually in the first webcast of around 85%. Really good. It's kind of the best tool-based solution that we have out there, which is why a lot of people have been leveraging that. But that applies to an individual basis of getting even around 59% accuracy based on the Bayesian algorithm. So it tends to not be enough for particularly finicky users who really expect more upfront. So in addition to that, then we look at, do we want to start building on smoke testing, right? And then if we want to do smoke testing, the question is, how much do we do? I have seen some customers who will literally just do an install. Does the application install? And what we find statistically is that about 60% of failing applications have a problem in the install. So that install testing would help me find those, having a human do that. Do my tools help me find a lot of that? Yes. The human finds more, right? So the human's going to be able to verify this looks like it installed correctly. Maybe not perfectly, right? Because everything may look fine. I may have a positive return code from the installer. If it was an MSI, I could have nothing in the error logs. And there still could be something that's critical that didn't end up being dropped. But it really does take that accuracy rate and raise it up dramatically if I have a human do the install. Beyond the install, I could have that person manually go in and actually launch the application, and we can catch, again, 80-20 rule, around 80% of applications that have a problem at runtime will have a problem at launch, and I can spot that. I won't necessarily find all of the bugs, but I can flag earlier on, hey, this one appears to not have any, and I will be right a significant amount of time, and I start to combine the accuracy of my tools with the accuracy of what that person is doing. And the more you poke around, the more things you may be able to uncover, being mindful that there's diminishing returns. A person who doesn't know how to use the software isn't necessarily going to find too many things. All we're trying to do is keep taking that accuracy rate and going higher, higher, higher. The user is our best bet for getting it highest. How much work do I want to put in up front is a really critical thing to negotiate as part of the program that you build. In the end, it's user acceptance testing that drives everything, and from a process perspective, this is one of the greatest opportunities to accelerate things because you're dealing with what's kind of like herding cats, if you will, right? We have a bunch of people who are not on the project who we are counting on to be successful with the delivery. if I have people who are sort of reliably showing up and that's very easy, I may not have any worries there. I may be able to just say, you know what, I'll just, you know, put you on the schedule and you're going to always show up. But more often what I find is that getting people to actually show up and perform the testing can require a more process-intensive approach and may require more resources to help manage that and help follow up and build the schedule and ensure that people are there and that they feel comfortable, right? So I want to be tracking my throughput at every step of the way, right? When I think about the initial portion, what a lot of people will do is take more of a factory or an industrialized services is kind of the latest buzzword, that kind of approach where I can track the velocity. How long does it take me to get the bits in order to do any testing whatsoever from a technology team perspective? How long is it taking me to do static analysis? How long is it taking me to do any manual install testing, any manual launch testing? How long do I spend doing that? I can track all of that. And similarly, I want to track my user acceptance testing. How many people have I got scheduled? Is scheduling the bottleneck? Are they not agreeing to show up? How many people are just not showing up? Is that the problem? How long are they spending? Is that the problem if I'm not hitting the throughput that I need to get my applications marked as green and ready to deploy so I can start lighting up those desktops? All of these things to track. Now, on the bottom of this process, we have the segment on remediation, which is a part of the process that we can get to from everywhere. I may have problems with installing it. I may have problems detected using tools. The user may have problems. Having a separate work stream here for remediation can be pretty important. And one of the things that I usually say to customers who are sort of building out their app compat workflow is to be mindful in the remediation space of which components of those that remediation is something that's truly reusable versus which are specific to this particular migration. Because one of the principles that I found that's helped people to be more successful is if the skill has ongoing utility, so understanding Windows security is one example. Understanding Windows security continues to be valuable even after you finish the migration. The specifics of the shims that you would have to use to get a failing application working for one operating system, for example, Windows 8 or Windows 7, does not continue to have value once you're done. Once your applications work on that platform, chances are you're not too likely to introduce something new which doesn't work on it. You'll catch that when you're doing the evaluation of the software. So that skill ceases to become interesting. And I point that out because the skills that continue to have value are skills that are worth owning. The skills that expire as soon as you're done are skills that you should consider renting from somebody else. It's a terrific place to engage partners who may have this domain-specific knowledge because they can reuse that over multiple customers. So getting a little bit more into remediation, you know, one of the things we want to make sure that we have a solid plan for is how we intend to perform that remediation and prioritize the way that we approach it. And for that, I like to bring it together as what I call here the remediation waterfall. You know, that means we're going to have a preference for how we remediate applications. And for nearly every customer I work with, that preference is, number one, first and foremost, I want to go in and fix the code, whether it's my code and I have to go in and write it directly, or whether I need to get a new version or a new app altogether to solve that problem. Having an application that's natively compatible is most people's absolute first preference. That being said, not everyone can afford to do that for every single application. It's simply not practical to take that approach for everything. You know, you may have an application where the deployment of the replacement may itself be a 12-month or longer project. And boy, wouldn't you like to be able to separate that project from being in the critical path of your app compat project. That's where we start waterfalling down into the other options. So the first option, and we'll go into great depth on this in the next section on remediation, is I can apply shims to fix that application, or I could potentially change a policy to remove the restriction or the change that's causing my application to fail. I'll want to weigh that, because if the policy is a security policy, turning off security settings is something that I want to do a very thorough cost value benefit analysis against. In the case of shims, it's a lot easier. I'll also basically want to understand what is the riskiness of this particular shim. How certain am I that it's going to reliably solve the problem in terms of determining whether that's a feasible option. But that allows me to run that application on the new OS. It's just had a little help to get me there. That's normally people's second choice. That being said, sometimes you can't fix a problem with shims. Shims are unable to fix every single problem. And sometimes there are not policies which I can turn on or off which allow me to fix the problem. Right? It's one that, you know, it could be based on some very low-level change in the operating system that's very fundamental, and I just don't have a workaround for it. So for that, the next step is typically looking at things like virtualization. So specifically in the example of transitioning from Windows XP to Windows 8 or Windows 7 or 8.1, server virtualization, I want to get higher compatibility with Windows XP, I look for Windows Server 2003, which has, you know, roughly the similar kernel. It was released about a year later, but they originally shared the same code base, and they have very similar, though not perfect, compatibility characteristics. It's a good thing to try. And the thing that people find about server virtualization to Server 2003 for Windows XP or for Windows Server 2008 versus Windows Vista or 2008 R2 for Windows 7, specifically with Server 2003, it buys me an extra year and a few months. The end of support for Windows XP is April 8th of 2014. The end of support for Windows Server 2003 is July of 2015. So I have a little bit more time to go in and resolve that issue. And buying that little bit of extra time might help me come to the long-term remediation of getting a new version or a new app or changing my code. It might buy me enough time to do that in a better way. All right, so I may want to look at that as my bridge solution until I get to that point. It does only buy me an extra year, and one of the things that we're noticing is that in the server virtualization space, a lot of people will run software on top of Windows Server 2003 to enhance the experience. And we are seeing some vendors who are building that experience who are looking to end-of-life their product prior to the end of life of Windows Server 2003. So even though you don't go into extended support for the server operating system, you may want to check and see whether you would have to go into extended support for the platform you're using to, you know, connect to the applications on that operating system. A lot of people are simply using those helper applications and connectors to avoid the user having to see that whole second desktop through a, you know, raw terminal services experience. There are some cases where I may not want to put in server virtualization either because I can't take a dependency on network connectivity, I need to work offline, or because I have an application that doesn't work on Server 2003 either, right? It's high compatibility, but not perfect. In that case, the final option is to continue running the old client operating system that I was running before, in a virtual environment, right, or sometimes even in a physical environment. I've seen people actually giving away machines running the old platform on it for now. Considerations to make there, that's the last choice. It's the last choice for a reason, because a lot of times, particularly for folks who are today looking at retiring Windows XP, my Windows XP virtual machine or physical machine is going to go end of life on the exact same way that it does for the day-to-day operation that the user is doing. So I have a, you know, potential challenge with support for that long term, whether I end up buying a support statement for, you know, extended custom support, or whether I look to go unsupported and try to isolate the network. I mean, there are some serious considerations if the client OS you are retiring and virtualizing as a compatibility bridge solution is itself going to be unsupported before you can have your long-term solution put in place. Historically, we had transitioned looking a lot more at client virtualization as its bridge solution. Today, particularly for folks coming off of XP, this is becoming less and less practical because, you know, the programs are running at this point pretty close to Windows XP end of life. So having XP as your solution, you're still going to be past end of life and it continues to be a problem. And you know, this sort of waterfall approach in communicating that turns out to be, you know, a really important aspect of being efficient. And that communication from a best practices standpoint, I can't possibly emphasize enough. When we look at, you know, some of the transitions that are being made between the technology team and the business, the first transition point that we typically see, you know, if we go back and look at the overall end-to-end workflow, is the transition to user acceptance testing, or here listed as customer acceptance testing, wherein we're reporting back to the business. Here's what we found. We believe this thing is working or not working, or we may have actually reached out to them as part of remediation when we initially found that failure. Helping the end user or the application owner to understand what data you have has proven to be a really big differentiator in terms of overall success. So when we invest the time to explain, your application is currently red based on this, and if we've just run, you know, a tool against it, we haven't validated it, we should tell them this data is on average this reliable, so therefore, you know, hey, your first step may be to validate, is it actually broken? Or if we know it's absolutely positively broken and will never install, then the communication should make sure that that's very clear, right? So that transition, helping them to understand, here's what we already know, and here's what we need your help with, right? So that communication is important. The other communication is when we reach out to them, particularly in the context of remediation, do they understand the waterfall approach that we have? Because the overall tendency of the typical end user is to reach out for the path of least resistance. Which of these choices represents the least amount of work for them? Typically, that means we'll just run it on some old platform. And the risk profile or the cost profile of running the old platform might make that your absolute last choice, but the ease of it may make it their first choice. So we need to make sure that we're saying we're going to start with this. Is it feasible for you to get a new version and to update within the time frame we have for the program? If not, we can possibly help you. A lot of technology teams will centralize the troubleshooting, you know, and remediation portion internally simply because it generally doesn't make sense to distribute that knowledge across the organization. Here's how you reach out to us, that communication. Right, and if you don't have that, here's what you can use in terms of virtualization and how long you can use it. That communication, explaining the decisions that are relevant to application owners and to end users, consistently tend to be reliable predictors of success as we navigate our way through the whole program end to end. You know, and in the end, when it comes right down to it, having a well-thought-out process that takes you end-to-end, right, that leverages tools where appropriate, but that isn't excessively reliant on tools, that is communicative, that crowdsources, and that gets the help of people, and really consolidates information into one solid thing, really helps to overcome the single largest challenge that we see with app compat projects, which is that an app compat project at the beginning is full of unknowns, and the unknowns never go away until we get to the end. They're super hard to plan around, but if you build a process, you're reflective, you track your success rate, and you build your process based on that, those are the customers we see being consistently successful when it comes to app compat projects. So with that, thank you for joining us for today's webcast on the app compat process and tools. Once again, my name is Chris Jackson. Hopefully you'll join us again for our next session, which will go into an even deeper dive on application remediation. So with that, have a great day, and thanks for joining us.